You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been 50 years since Adolf Eichmann was put on trial in Israel, accused of transporting millions of European Jews to death camps during the Holocaust. Unlike the post-World War II Nuremberg trials, the Eichmann proceedings were televised, an event watched across the world, and it was the first opportunity for survivors of the Holocaust to publicly testify. In her new book called The Eichmann Trial, historian Deborah E. Lipstadt provides a detailed chronicle of the case along with an account of Eichmann's capture and sentencing. It also analyzes the trial's significance on the way scholars and the general public interpret and understand the Holocaust today. Schocken Books is the publisher, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Deborah Lipstadt back to our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
Was the Holocaust something the publics of Israel and elsewhere around the world talked about much at the time of the Eichmann trial?
They talked about it more than we think they did. There was discussion. Survivors spoke. Survivors told their story. There were books about it. There were even some movies. But the world didn't listen the way it began to listen at the Eichmann trial.
Well, it was 20 years after. My experience, speaking to some people who had been through the Holocaust, was that they were rather reluctant to talk about it, and often they only open up fairly late in their lives.
I think that's partially true. I also think that many of the people who had survived were really in a race to rebuild their lives, to rebuild their families, to find a profession. And not to move on, but they had other demands on them rather than recollecting.
And that would also true of politicians in Israel, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They would have preferred to focus on the future and building a stronger nation.
If they referred to the Holocaust, if they looked back, it was as a counterpoint. That was then, now we're now. We are different. This won't happen again because of the state of Israel.
What about younger Israelis? Were they at all interested in what was happening with the trial? Many of them were the children of European immigrants.
If they were the children of European immigrants, if they were the children of survivors particularly, they heard the stories in most cases, not in all homes, but in many cases they heard the stories at home. But I think in Israel generally, for the younger generation, for the tzabars, for the sabras, the children born in Israel, born after the Holocaust, there was a sense that this would never happen to us. We're different. And I think the trial both strengthened that and changed it. It reinforced the notion that it wouldn't happen to us because we have an army and we're strong. But it also made them realize, as they watched the succession of witnesses go on the stand, there were close to 100 survivors who testified. They were young men and women. They were in their 30s and their 40s. They weren't different from them. They were the same. You began to realize that it was more a matter of geography than of the human person, the person's makeup.
How was it covered in this country? Was there a lot of interest?
There was a lot of interest. In the beginning, the first couple of days, and of course on the second day of the trial, Yuri Gagarin goes into space, and then you have the Bay of Pigs. So things push it off the front page. But there is a lot of interest in the way there hadn't been for the Nuremberg trials. There also, the interest is heightened in the way Eichmann is captured or kidnapped, choose your words, and brought to Israel by the Israelis.
Which sounds like something out of a spy novel.
It really does. The truth of the matter is many people knew Eichmann was there. The Argentinians, where he was, the Argentinian police knew he was there. There were people in the German government who knew he was there. But the information once given to the Israelis, and the Germans pushed the Israelis, Fritz Bauer, a German prosecutor, pushed the Israelis to act. And Ben-Gurion, Prime Minister Ben-Gurion, made a fateful decision. He could have said, go to Buenos Aires, bump the guy off. It'll be a signal to all the other Nazi war criminals in Argentina and other places, don't sleep so soundly in your bed. But instead, Ben-Gurion said, get him and bring him back here and put him on trial.
Wasn't Argentina criticized for providing a safe haven for former Nazi officers?
Yes.
Not just Eichmann. Dr. Mengele lived in Argentina, and the people used to joke Adolf Hitler is alive and well in Argentina.
Argentina was criticized. One of the things that drove Argentina to welcome these people, they didn't go out and seek Nazi war criminals and sort of say, you know, come Nazi war criminals, come here. But Argentina was anxious to attract quote-unquote white Europeans who were educated.
This is also during the Perón years,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes.
And he had kind of fascist sympathies.
He had fascist sympathies. Not only did he have fascist sympathies, but, for instance, the Argentinian ambassador to the UN, who made a big fuss about what happened and insisted that the UN deliberate about it, had been a supporter of the fascists.
Hadn't Eichmann been arrested right after the war?
He was
released.
He was arrested and he escaped. He hid his name. He escaped, and he escaped with the aid of other SS people in the prison camp where he was. He was in Germany for a while after that, and then as his name became better known, he realized he should get out. And with the help of the Vatican and the Red Cross, he got out of Europe.
When Eichmann was, are we going to use the word kidnapped? Anyway, when
he was
captured and transported to Israel, what was the reaction of other countries? Did they see it as a violation of Argentinian sovereignty?
It was a mixed reaction. Officially, many countries saw it as a violation of Argentinian sovereignty. But there was the press in many countries, including in Germany and in Argentina. Argentinian press began to say, why do we have these Nazis here? And let's not forget that this guy was responsible for incarcerating 1,400 Jews who had Argentinian passports in a concentration camp when they were about to get out. So there was a mixed feeling. The most interesting reaction was Germany. Many people said, well, he shouldn't be tried in Israel, he should be tried in Germany. The truth of the matter is Konrad Adenauer, the chancellor of Germany, had no desire to bring him to Germany.
But weren't there known former Nazi officials who were working in the German government involved?
That's exactly why Adenauer didn't want to bring him to Germany, because it would have called attention. Eichmann could have turned around and said, you put me on trial. You have this one as the head of your chancellery, as your chief of staff. You have another one in your foreign embassy. You have a government that's riddled with Nazis. Why are you attacking me?
Had Israel protested that, or was Israel too dependent on money that was coming from Germany in reparations?
Israel kept quiet about that. Ben-Gurion was beginning to build relations with Germany. Ben-Gurion felt he needed German support, he needed German arms, he needed German funds, and eventually he wanted to have relations with Germany. And the last thing he wanted was to call attention to that. So actually, Adenauer's great ally in separating Nazi Germany from post-war Germany was David Ben-Gurion.
My guest is Deborah E. Lipstadt. Her latest book, The Eichmann Trial, which is published by Schocken. When he was arrested, did people recognize his name?
Some did, some didn't. His name was not that well known.
It wasn't as prominent as the people who had been tried at Nuremberg.
Not at all, and it wasn't on the same level as people knew the name, certainly Hitler, Himmler, Heydrich, Göring. But many people began to learn. At Nuremberg, his name came out, and people began to know his name then.
And it's always weird to ask this question, but because there are just so many different opinions in any community. But didn't this kind of polarize Jewish communities in Israel and abroad?
Less so in Israel. In Israel, there was a polarization about whether he should get the death penalty or not. And there were certain people such as Martin Buber, the philosopher, and Gershon Scholem, the great scholar of mysticism, and other Hebrew University professors, and some witnesses at the trial who felt he shouldn't be executed. But in Israel, there was a great deal of pride. Eichmann is in our hands, and he's in our hands, and we're going to give him a fair trial. We're going to give him the kind of trial he didn't give to his victims.
But there were people who felt we had to get beyond victimization.
Yeah, well, this wasn't seen so much as victimization. This was seen as justice. But in this country, there was a tremendous split. There were American Jews who were very nervous about Israel putting him on trial. They were nervous that it would cast doubt on their loyalties to America. Eventually, people came around, but in the beginning, there was a great deal of opposition.
What was he indicted for?
He was indicted for crimes against the Jewish people. He was indicted for crimes against humanity. The major part of the indictment was about what he did to the Jews, but he was also indicted for crimes against handicapped crimes, which he wasn't involved in, but he was indicted for crimes against other peoples as well, non-Jews as well.
Did most of the witnesses who testified in his trial have some direct contact with him?
Many did not. In fact, most probably did not. And this was a point of great contention. Israel was under the impression, and actually historians had this impression at the time, that the Holocaust was this organized, top-down kind of event and action. But it wasn't. And Eichmann was not as important as the Israelis assumed he was. They sort of thought of him as the CEO of the Holocaust when he was the COO, one of the COOs. He was responsible for
He wasn't an architect, as he's often described.
Not at all. He was not an architect. He followed the orders, but he followed the orders with a small staff. He went way and above beyond what he was ordered. He chased down every Jew he could. Their perception was, and Gideon Hausner, the prosecutor's perception was, I'm going to tell the whole story of what happened, even if some of it doesn't directly connect to Eichmann.
How prepared was Gideon Hausner to take on the case?
He wasn't prepared when he first began. He became a student of history. He read up on it. He was very good on certain things, and he made some very big mistakes. He accused Eichmann of things that he wasn't guilty of. But I think his lasting decision has momentous implications. And it was his decision to tell the story, have the story told in the first person singular, have these people, one after another, tell what happened to them. It gave what some scholars have called semantic authority to the survivors in a way that they hadn't had before.
On a strictly legal basis, do you think that Eichmann got a fair trial?
I think he got a fair-ish trial. He was guilty. The documents showed he was guilty. The documents showed how much he was involved. It wasn't an entirely fair trial. His defense attorney, whose fees were paid by Israel, didn't have the freedom to really aggressively cross-examine the witnesses. He had the freedom to do it, but he knew it wouldn't win him favor. He was outclassed by the team that Israel assembled.
And what was the defense?
The defense was, I was just following orders. I wasn't guilty. I was just following orders. You're putting me on trial. We're the big fish. I'm one of the little fish. We're the big fish. But they were able to show just how dramatically he was involved and directly he was involved.
But you also say Hausner got history wrong in what's considered one of the most emotionally evocative moments in the trial, his opening remarks.
Well, I don't know if he got history wrong. He opens the trial with a paragraph that he adds the night before. And there are, in fact, many Israelis who can, to this day, who can quote it to you by heart. And I paraphrase where he says, judges of Israel, I don't stand here before you alone. With me are standing 6 million. They are here, but their voices are silent. And we are confronting the man who was like Pharaoh, who was like Haman, who was like Chmielnitsky in Poland. And we say Jacques Hughes. So he was connecting Eichmann in a long line of anti-Semites. And I think what Hausner and many people failed to understand at that time, and this is what Hannah Arendt got right, is that, yes, there was anti-Semitism there. She misses the anti-Semitism. But what was different was, unlike those previous murderers, unlike those previous anti-Semites, the Nazi conception of what was to be done was far larger and far grander and far more extensive.
A moment of great significance during the trial was when Hausner questioned some of the witnesses on why they hadn't revolted. Weren't there a lot of questions even by other Jews as to why the victims hadn't fought harder to stay alive?
Yes, he does question a number of the witnesses, why didn't you fight back? And there were many people who took Hausner to task for that. Why did you do that? And I think what he was trying to show was that these people had faced such overwhelming odds. They were by themselves. They were if they had revolted, if they had tried to escape, as one witness said, a magistrate from Tel Aviv, where were we supposed to go? He said, the magistrate says, we were in this camp, and along with us right in the adjacent camp were Poles. All they had to do was break out and go 200 yards to their homes. They didn't get out. Where could we have gone?
You mentioned Hannah Arendt. On the cover of the book, we have photos of Eichmann, Hausner, and Hannah Arendt. Because she's such an important part of the story,
she
opened up a big debate when she wrote an article in The New Yorker. And she was harshly criticized by many who felt that she was kind of excusing anti-Semitism.
Well, she wrote not one article, but four articles in The New Yorker, and then published as a book, Eichmann in Jerusalem on the Banality of Evil. On some level, she's more important than Eichmann. She opened an intellectual discussion. She jump-started the field of Holocaust studies. And there's a debate today. When I told people I was writing the book on the Eichmann trial, some people, without pausing, would say to me, and what about Arendt? That was like, you know, this is a point-counterpoint. She got some things terribly wrong. She said that she was very critical, devastatingly critical of the Jewish councils in the ghettos, which the Nazis had established, these councils to administer the ghettos. And she said the people in the ghettos faced two enemies, Nazis and the Jews who were in these councils. She painted 1,000 different councils with one broad brush. She got that wrong. She didn't understand the role anti-Semitism played. She thought of Eichmann as a clown who deserved to die. She said he's a small cog. He wasn't a big cog. She got that right. But she, and small cogs are just as important to a machine as a large cog. Take it out, it won't work. What she got right was, first of all, recognizing that this was a crime that transcended just anti-Semitism, number one. Number two, when some people say this trial shouldn't be in Israel, she says, first of all, she says to Carl Jaspers in a letter, her professor, we found him, we captured him, we brought him here. And to say that Israel didn't exist is so formalistic and out of touch with reality that it shouldn't even be considered. Then she goes on to say in the book, and it's a powerful statement, she said the Eichmann trial was the first time since the year 70, since the Romans sacked the temple in Jerusalem, that Jews could sit in judgment of a non-Jew who had done them harm. And, you know, Ben-Gurion couldn't have said it more strongly.
In thinking about Holocaust studies, can we say there was a pre-Eichmann period and a post-Eichmann period?
Yes. I think in the post-Eichmann period, the studies begin to become much more serious, much more in-depth. Raoul Hilberg has published his book around that time. And it begins a 50-year process that is still going on today.
And affected you when you accused David Irving of being a Holocaust denier and he sued you for libel. Why do you think there still are Holocaust deniers when there's just so much evidence?
Because Holocaust deniers are not deniers because they haven't gotten enough evidence. Holocaust deniers are essentially anti-Semites. Anti-Semitism is prejudice, is a form of prejudice. Prejudge, it's irrational. They've made up their mind. And these are people who have found this way of expressing their anti-Semitism. David Irving is not missing the facts. David Irving has enough of the facts to know what happened. He just twists them and turns them, because, motivated as he is by his anti-Semitism.
Deborah E. Lipstadt is Dart Professor of Modern Jewish History and Holocaust Studies at Emory University, author of a number of books. The most recent, The Eichmann Trial, which is published by Schocken Books. Thank you so much for being with us
again. Thank you for having me.